You've tuned to The Turley Frequency, starring your host, Kevin Turley, with guest stars Mike Romano and Reed Hodges, and special guest stars, the members of the FCC, whom we respect respectfully. Now, time to get tuned into The Frequency. Call the show at 888-928-0881. That's 888-928-0881. Or text us at 251-928-2111. And now we cross live to the Archangel Radio Studios in downtown Fairhope to at last feel the Turley Frequency.
Welcome to this week's edition of the Turley Frequency, here live and exclusive on Archangel Radio. Today on the show, we meet Julian Peters, who is a comic specializing in bringing classic poems to life for a new audience via the art of the cartoon. We speak with Julian in the next segment. Top of the hour, we pray the Divine Mercy Chaplet, and guess what? You're invited to join us. That's right. Feel free to text me your prayer requests on 251-928-2111. In the final segment today, we hear the story of how a nation was spared due to the intercession of our Blessed Mother all around the 15th of August. Okay, with all this good stuff, let's get this show on the road. Hello and welcome to Monday's edition of the Turley Frequency, a new week. It's a new month, I guess. It's not July anymore. We're into August. This is good. Not really a new host, though. You've got the same old me and the same old Reed and the same old that we serve up every single week. But I hope it's enjoyable one way or another. Now, before we start the show, I guess we'd better check that all our systems this week are up to the usual standard and ready to go. Reed, are we all set for another week on the Turley Frequency?
Give me a go, no go for launch. Booster.
Go.
Retro.
Go.
Vital.
We're go flying.
Guidance.
Guidance go.
Surgeon.
Go flight.
Ecom.
We're go flight.
GNC.
We're go.
Telemu.
Go.
Control.
Go flight.
Procedures.
Go.
Inco.
Go.
FAO.
We are go.
Network.
Go.
Recovery.
Go.
Capcom.
We're go flight.
Launch control, this is Houston. We are go for launch.
Well, Reed, I don't know how many people you got working with you today, but it sounds like we have a full team and we are ready for blast off here on the Turley Frequency.
Yes, now, Kevin, the studio is as full as ever, but I don't think I run the risk of being confused for a NASA astronaut or a NASA, at least the computer people.
Yes, though your job is to blast me into space. Whether I come back or not, that's a whole different ballgame.
Yes,
and we'll find out.
That's another department. I'm only worried about getting you out there, and then another department handles getting you back.
I believe Ellen and Mike are investing in a very large net for my re-entry into the universe when I drop through the sky. But anyway, listen, you know what it is today, of course. We are in the throes of that beautiful moment when we have 9 days before the 15th of August, okay? 9 days to do a novena to our Blessed Mother and one of those great feasts, the Feast of the Assumption. Now, the month, as our friend Jim, good morning to you, Jim, told us last week, the month of August is dedicated to the Immaculate Heart of Mary. So why not make a novena to her Immaculate Heart for the August 15th Feast of the Assumption? Now, already when I was preparing for this show and I was thinking about this show, some of the news items were coming my way. I could tell you that the theme for this week is definitely going to be around mothers. Mothers and their children. Especially the errant variety. Of which I was one, okay? So I know what it's like. I put my poor mother through it. Oh, may she rest in peace. Please forgive me, Mum. Anyway, now, in fact, we, so, you know, last week we had that beautiful audio message from our friend Luis, who is a sailor out on the high seas. Remember, she's sailing from the Pacific, from Malaysia into Europe, and I think she was just entering into the Mediterranean when she sent us that beautiful message about how much all your prayer during the Divine Mercy Chaplet meant to her and her fellow crew members on board the good ship, whatever it's called. I don't think she told us the name of the ship, which is a shame. I'd like to know the name of the ship. But they were really, really touched that this little radio station in Alabama is praying for them, praying for their safe journey, but also for their safe return to the real port that we all have to get to one day. And you know what I'm talking about, right? Well, it started a craze. We seem to have received another audio from a listener. Now, this is a prayer request from a mother. Reed, I wonder if we could just play that sound request in full. Very touching, very moving, from a mother. Not sure I got the full request there, Reed. Do you think maybe we could just play it again in case any of our audience missed this? Just to recap, this is a heartfelt prayer request from a mother who listens to the show.
I think this is the correct one, Kevin. I'll try it again.
Could you? That would be just great. Yes, I think I got it this time. That is the normal prayer of every mother listening to this show when it comes to her children, certainly one time or another. Now, talking of mothers, last week we talked a lot about World Youth Day. Do you remember? World Youth Day? What, you've forgotten already? World Youth Day, the huge event which took place in Lisbon, Portugal. Millions of people, and was millions, turned up to pray with Pope Benedict, mostly young people. Do you remember we had Ivo Bender on the show on Friday, reporting to us live from Lisbon? And it's by all accounts, it's been an amazing experience for many, many people. Now, I haven't quite got to the bottom of this yet, and I need to do what journalists call due diligence. But late on Saturday night, I started getting texts from somebody at World Youth Day. And if the story that was coming through is true, and I have no reason to doubt it is, but I need to check it out for you, for everybody's sake, it's going to blow your socks off. We pray for miracles on this show, but believe you me, sometimes even I'm awestruck at the goodness of God. I'll come back to that. You're going to have to stay tuned each week till I reveal this story to you. If it is what I think, you're in for something out of this world. But a number of other stories have come to my attention. They've been reported by various news agencies. For example, the very touching one about Michaela Rafina, a 31-year-old mother from Mozambique. And Michaela suffers from a rare disease. But 3 years ago, she became a mother. And this year, she went to World Youth Day to thank Our Lady for the miracle of her pregnancy. Now, Michaela suffers from a disease which causes heart problems, and it limits her growth and gives her weak bones and that type of thing. Don't ask me the medical name for it. Maybe you don't need to know. You just need to know she's a woman who doesn't enjoy good health. And the health complications got worse. And the medical professionals in her home in Mozambique said she could never be a mother, right? That was something that was just not going to happen. In fact, the doctors told her, and I quote, it would be difficult in such a situation because she would have to choose between her life and the life of the baby. So guess what? Michaela got pregnant. What did she do? She decided just to keep going, keep going. Do you remember we heard the wonderful tale of Chiara? Remember that beautiful Italian mother? Michaela was in the same sort of arena. She was a devout Catholic. She knew that she couldn't destroy the life in her womb, but she knew that the whole circumstance of her being pregnant with her medical complications, her life, the mother's life, Michaela's life, was in danger. So what did she do? Well, she does what any sensible Catholic does in situations like that. She turned to Our Lady. She prayed to her. And quotes, Mary did a miracle for me during my pregnancy. Kept her alive and kept the baby alive until her daughter was born. She's got a three years old little daughter now, Michaela. But she went to World Youth Day so she could testify in her words about Our Lady and to thank Our Lady for everything she's done for me. For any mothers listening to this who are at their wit's end about their children or about whatever, there's Michaela traveling in a wheelchair to World Youth Day to give thanks to Our Lady. I've just seen a very beautiful photograph of her. She is a very physically disabled young woman, and yet she is so full of life, so full of thankfulness to Our Lady. Now, we have another mother, and this mother comes from Alabama, and she went all the way to World Youth Day. That's right. Where do you hear this? This is a mother from Alabama. And EWTN caught up with her, and there's a short video they have. Her name is Christina Saunders. Good morning to anybody who knows Christina, and she's a mother from the Diocese of Birmingham, Alabama. And this is what she had to say to EWTN at the recent World Youth Day in Lisbon, Portugal.
This is my son, Charlie. He didn't get to come with us. He would love to, but he's starting college. He's moving into college today, and we thought it was real important for him to make connections at college that first week before school starts, the classes start. This is my first World Youth Day, and we are loving it. You can see Jesus' presence everywhere. People standing out in the heat and the sun. Nobody wanted to move because they want to be close to Jesus. They want to be there in adoration. We're all standing here hoping to get a glimpse of the Pope. It's been miraculous. It's just miraculous. And we want Charlie to be a part of it, and so this is the way we're having him a part of it. He's 18 years old, yeah. And we named this one Flat Charlie. And so people are taking pictures with him. They're praying for him. They're sending him videos, and he's just feeling the love back in Birmingham.
Now, I know you're wondering, well, wait a minute. How is Charlie there and Charlie is back in Birmingham, Alabama? Well, what Christina did was she took a cardboard cutout of her son's head, put it on the end of a pole, and is walking around Lisbon, Portugal, World Youth Day, introducing strangers and anybody who's interested to Charlie, her 18-year-old son.
Yes, that would be who she identified as Flat Charlie.
That's Flat Charlie is the backside of the cardboard cutout. But if you look at the photograph, there's a very nice picture of a young Charlie being carried around by his mother, and she is introducing Charlie to millions of people there in Lisbon, Portugal. Now, I don't know about you, but that is one mother's devotion to a son. She knew he couldn't be there. He had to attend a week-long gathering before his college classes begin. He wanted to be there, so she took him. Vicariously, she took him on the end of a pole with a little photograph, and now he's all over the media, all over the social media. You know, the love of a mother, it never ends. It really doesn't end. It really doesn't end. Okay, now, one of the things about being a mother, of course, is at this time in these days of the novena, we're thinking about the love of our Blessed Mother for all of us. She really is a mother to us, if we let her be that mother to us. And you remember we talked about on this show about whether we were going to do the consecration to the Immaculate Heart of Mary, well, through the Immaculate Heart of Mary to the Sacred Heart of Jesus. Do you remember? And we got 11 people who came forward to suggest, yes, I want to be part of this. There's David, Jim, Chuck, Lee, Mary, T, Amal, Marguerite, Louise, Kay, Kristen, and Mary. Another Mary. And there was also an anonymous. All of you came forward, and we haven't forgotten about that. We're looking maybe at starting that or doing that maybe on August 15th. Let me know what you think. Let me know what you think, because it may be worth doing, or maybe you think, nah, not such a good idea. Who needs that? I think we need it. I'll be doing it anyway. But whether we want to consecrate the whole show, everybody who works on it, everybody at Archangel, and also you, our dear listener, Everybody's listening. You get the benefits, the spiritual benefits of that consecration. Now, what they are and how it all works, I'm hoping to get Father Boniface Hicks back. I know Michelle's doing a lot to get him back on the show so we can start to talk about what this all means. So, what do you think? Call me. Call me on 888-928-0881 or text me on 251-928-2111. Let me know what you think. And you can always leave a voice message, you know. We're very happy to receive voice messages. If you don't want to come on air, if it's too much for you, just leave a voice message. We'll be very happy to play it.
Kevin, we have a voice message ready right here.
Oh, wonderful. This is great. Somebody's already called in. Well, we better play it. Let's find out what they have to say.
See, there had to be a Mary. There had to be. And that's why we celebrate the Assumption of Our Lady today. From the very beginning of Christianity, it was always believed that she was assumed into heaven. You say, well, why should she be so different? Well, because she was created by God. Before time began, he had her in his mind to be the mother of his Son, the Eternal Word. What does the angel say to Our Lady? Hail, full of grace, full of God. She wouldn't be full of God if she had the slightest imperfection because she was so pure and so holy. There was no reason for her to rot away like we're going to. It couldn't happen to Our Lady. Just couldn't. God's temple had to be absolutely perfect for his sake. And Our Lady had to be awesome because she always said yes to God.
Well, that was one heck of a phone message from none other than Mother Angelica. She must be listening to the show from on high, but she's absolutely right, you know. She's absolutely right. In fact, I started just the weekend a wonderful book about Our Lady, which I will be talking to you about nonstop for the next 9 days. It's called Jesus and the Jewish Roots of Mary, Unveiling the Mother of the Messiah by Brant Petrie. I tell you, it's a great read. Do you know what? I was sitting on the underground yesterday in London reading it, and it was just great. You know, one of those books that you know it's good because you almost miss your stop. That's how you know how good the book is. It's a wonderful, wonderful book. But listen, I really want to encourage you to do the novena to Our Blessed Mother. So what am I to do about that? I mean, I'm just wondering, Reed, do you think we should maybe pray it on her every single day? What do you reckon?
The entire novena, Kevin?
Well, no, we just say a short prayer each day on air, but it's part of a 9-day novena. What do you reckon?
Of course, yeah, that sounds like a plan.
Okay, well, I'm going to pray a very, very ancient prayer to Our Lady. In fact, I think it's one of the oldest prayers after the Hail Mary, of course, and it's one of the shortest, which is good as well. I like short prayers. And you probably know it. It's often called "We Fly to Thy Protection." And it goes as follows. We fly to thy protection, O Holy Mother of God. Do not despise our petitions in our necessities, but deliver us always from all our dangers, O glorious and blessed Virgin. That's it. That's it.
Amen.
Amen. Thank you, Reed. If we've joined in, you're in the game. We are up and running like the NASA flight crew. We are systems go for this novena. Because you know what? What have you got to lose? Do you remember I told you the story of that man? Reed, do you remember the story of the man who did the novena, who had his life changed? Remember he had a major spinal problem and he was losing his ability to walk and all the rest of it?
Yes, that's incredible.
And do you remember that was because of a novena that he did to a man who's a venerable? I think he's not even a blessed. Well, the story I heard at the weekend, again around World Youth Day, was as a result of a novena. And I'm beginning to think I'm getting the message. These novenas are powerful. So why not join with us each morning here on Archangel Radio, here on the Turley Frequency, and we're going to pray this little prayer every single day. And as long as you're hearing it, you're part of the family, you're part of the show, you're part of the novena. So start to think about what you want Our Lady to give you during these 9 days. I'm sure there's something or someone that you want to pray for. Okay, when we come back, we're changing gears. We're heading to speak to Julian Peters about the art of the comic. Yep, and it's not humor we're talking about. It's the sort of ink and pen sort of variety of comics. So stay tuned to the Turley Frequency here live and exclusive on Archangel Video. back to the Turley Frequency here, live and exclusive on Archangel Radio. It is great to have your company this Monday morning. I hope wherever you are, whatever you're doing, it is going well for you. Now, my next guest is an illustrator and comic book artist living in Montreal, Canada, who focuses on adapting classical poems into graphic art. His name is Julian Peters, and his work has been exhibited internationally and published in several poetry and graphic art collections. It came across my radar on account of his adapting classic poems into the visual medium of comic art. And Julian joins me down the line this morning. Julian, welcome to the Turley Frequency.
Hello, thank you. It's great to be here with you.
Now, Julian, most people, when you say comics, those of us of a certain age, we have images of sort of comic strips, you know, with a gag in them somewhere. But the world right. of comic art and the art of the comic has progressed somewhat in those intervening 40-odd years.
Quite a bit. And it's true that in English, the word is comic, so it's associated with gag strips and funnies in general, but yeah, there's no reason why comics should be focused on one particular genre or another, right? Just like any medium, I suppose, any artistic medium like film or indeed like literature, it could be applied to any subject matter.
Well, that's right. And probably, I mean, and we'll talk about this, I'm sure, that the development of the graphic novel is very closely linked in some ways to the cinematic experience. It's that sort of visual image that's playing with the mind as opposed to what's written on the page. But before we get there, I mean, I was looking at some of your poems, some of the poems that you've put to the image. It's quite startling. I mean, you've illustrated one that a poem I really love, which is William Wordsworth, The World Is Too Much With Us. And I thought, well, how is he going to do this? And I was really amazed at the way in which you sort of collected the images and put them to the poem and so forth. I mean, I know this is a question all creatives get asked, and perhaps there's no real answer. Perhaps it's a slightly unfair question. But how in the world did those ideas and the images sort of collide together in what I see before me?
Well, in the case of the William Wordsworth sonnet, so it was pairing the lines that are sort of bemoaning the influence of the Industrial Revolution on human society and human I guess solidarity or togetherness in the early 19th century, and so I thought of pairing that with visual images that recall like our own technology, our own sort of alienating technology in the form of cell phones, basically of smartphones and social media. But a lot of the time, so that one was a little bit more, I suppose, trying to be clever a little bit, like finding a parallel between the subject matter of the past and the present. But a lot of the time it's much more instinctual, I think. I read the poem and certain images kind of spontaneously present themselves to my mind, or they sort of brew slowly in my mind and I don't quite realize exactly what they are, but I feel that there are some images in the back of my head if I really were to concentrate on them. And I think this exercise of adapting things visually forces me to find the visual equivalent to the text.
I mean, I get that totally, Julian. However, as we both know, the whole sort of game of the poet is to direct our imaginations to certain images, mental images or feelings or whatever. So you're sort of coming at it very differently in that, you know, I mean, Wordsworth obviously was not thinking about the cell phone when he was writing what he wrote, but you're coming at it and sort of almost transcending what Wordsworth is directing you to and turning it into something which is very much your own, right?
Yeah, well, there is that little bit of a risk of falling into something too literal, I suppose, like mm-hmm. of illustrating something too close to what's in the text. So it is always a little bit of a play between trying to find something that is visually connected to the text or sort of plays off it or enriches it in a way without it being redundant, you know, without just repeating what is in the text. But a lot of the time, in the case of the Wordsworth poem, it was commissioned to me to adapt. So I might not have a particular concept. It might not be that the poem spoke to me right away, but I will sit with the text for a long time and sort of, you know, poke at it from different angles and see if there's some lines that kind of inspire a kind of line of thinking. I don't remember which line it was, perhaps, in that poem that made me make the connection with smartphones, but I think once that visual or conceptual connection is made, then I can sort of think it out a little bit more deliberately, like how can I make all the other lines kind of fit in with this concept? What can I bring out in every line? What is there a word, a key word maybe that I can make a bridge to the concept I'm trying to get across? And also, I think one has to think. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No, yeah, just following on from that, Julian. I'm wondering, like, when that initial germ of an idea, a visual idea, plants itself. Do you then, I mean, does the poem then sort of resonate with that idea, that somehow your own idea then starts to grow, develop, and run almost parallel to the text?
Yeah, I think so, very much. It might start with that sort of instinctual connection at some point. But then I'm also thinking in terms of the language of comics, there's certain elements that have to be respected, but also certain elements, I suppose, that are sort of an advantage of comics. There's, first of all, there's always kind of a narrative element to a comic, right, to a certain extent. So always kind of creating some kind of a narrative arc, I think, in a poem, in the adaptation of the poem, even if the poem itself is just maybe exploring an emotion or just a series of impressions. I'm trying to find some way that I can kind of create a little bit of a narrative throughout, woven through the text, kind of.
I mean, I get it with, I mean, certain poems lend themselves to that narrative, you know. I mean, the Charge of the Light Brigade, for example, a classic, you know, middle and end, and you got a momentum, you got a whole. But when I came across God's Grandeur, Gerald Manley Hopkins. Now, Gerald Manley Hopkins is obviously one of the great poets of certainly the late 19th century. He's revered in Catholic circles because he was a Jesuit and all the rest. However, I would wager that an awful lot of very good people don't understand a word of what Gerald Manley Hopkins is writing about. I mean, the imagery is complex. The imagery is dense. It's difficult. Sometimes he uses language in ways that are certainly not familiar even to educated people. And to my eyes and ears, the idea of a narrative within that is really a stretch. How did you approach his poetry?
Well, for God's Grandeur, I think, well, first of all, of course, the imagery is very rich. So I was looking to, and also, I guess, rich in imagery. Also, it kind of has this, a lot of the Hopkins poems have this kind of propulsive, almost like explosive quality to them. Like the language kind of transports you on this kind of musical lilt that it has. So I wanted to have visually, I guess, graphically for the page to kind of have a sense of like the imagery kind of bursting forth in many directions and maybe not so linearly as in a lot of comics and comics I've done, even where you have the panels, many panels in succession. So I tried to break that up with more original page layouts and a lot of colors. In terms of the narrative, I think I was looking, I think the lines that maybe I kind of latched on to were the ones about how the humans have, generations of humans have trod over the land. They don't reckon with the rod of God, so they're not fearing God's wrath. They're destroying the nature in which his grandeur can be seen. And then, you know, with the landscape being bleared, smeared with toil. So I was kind of building up on that, the destruction of the nature that we see at the beginning. And then there was the part about the last light on the horizon. I don't remember exactly how it went towards the end. So I was thinking, it's kind of the end, a destruction maybe, that I kind of brought in to this theme of deforestation, which appears in a lot of the imagery to illustrate man's trotting over nature. So the deforestation ends with, as we are seeing a lot this summer, forest fires. And then there is kind of like a rebirth at the end. So the suggestion with the line about the sun rising again is shown with the sun rising over a large jungle, a very thriving jungle. But then in the last panel, we realize that the human beings have perhaps become extinct, perhaps led to our own extinction. So there's just ruins of human civilization, and nature has taken over once again. But there is, I did add a little detail that there's a little plume of smoke arising from the forest at the bottom of the page, of the last page, which would suggest that some humans have survived this environmental apocalypse, and maybe there's going to be a new kind of a new civilization will spring up, and hopefully one more in harmony with nature.
One hopes so. Okay, we're in conversation with Julian Peters this morning. Stay tuned to the Turley Frequency here live and exclusive on Archangel Radio. Back to the Turley Frequency here live and exclusive on Archangel Radio. It's great to have your company this Monday. I'm in conversation with Julian Peters, who is a comic. No, not that sort of comic. He doesn't tell jokes. He draws. He illustrates. That's what that comic is all about. Julian, you must come up against this all the time. I mean, I know graphic novels have done an awful lot to improve the standing of comics, you know, comic designers and drawers around the world. But I mean, it's often seen, it's probably not seen with the same sort of gravitas as other art forms. Is that a fair observation?
Yeah, that's definitely always been the case, I think. Always been disparaged as an artistic medium since it's been around for about 100 years now, comics. Whereas poetry, of course, is sort of the opposite end of, it's been around, it seems like, for as long as humans have been creating or writing, or even beforehand, and it's always had a very noble kind of aura around it. So it's interesting to pair these kind of two extremes of the kind of spectrum of cultural prestige, I think.
Yes, no, it is interesting, you know, great, you're right. I think poets have a great kudos. They're often penniless in my experience, the poets I know. anyway,
true.
but they have a great
although
sort
comics
of
are, yeah.
But that, I
better.
Think that's part of their stick, Julian, that they wander around penniless but observing the world and commenting on it, and then we're all the better, all the richer for it if they're no richer.
Yeah.
But talk talk to me a little bit about the rise of the comic novel. I first came across graphic novels probably about 30 years ago with Watchmen and that sort of thing that started to sort of penetrate into the mainstream culture. And I was quite surprised when I would come across adults reading these and say, what is this? And they would explain. And then I started to see that there was this underground movement that has now become very, very mainstream. Is that your experience, that you sort of stumbled into it, or were you always a devotee of the graphic novels and their precursors?
Well, my personal experience is a bit unusual because I grew up in large part in Italy, actually. So my mother's Italian, so I'm half Italian and half Canadian. And in Italy, they have a very different attitude towards comics. Since I think going back to the 60s, comics began to be read by adults, and they were championed by a lot of intellectuals. Umberto Eco, for instance, was a big proponent of comics.
Right.
So by the time I was growing up there, I feel like there was sort of already a tradition of kind of, I guess you could say, sort of like auteur comics aimed at adults and dealing with more adult themes. And even the comics I was reading as a kid, they weren't necessarily humorous comics or superhero comics. There was a lot of, there's a big tradition in Italy of kind of using comics as an educational tool. So there'd be a lot of like adaptations of literary classics into comics, you know, tales from history, from the Bible in comics. So there was that sense that comics could be used to educate, and they could deal with very, you know, serious themes and even religious themes. So maybe that was why I didn't have that prejudice against comics. I think that is quite widespread, was quite widespread in North America.
Well, I think across the Anglophone world, it's a prejudice which is probably predicated on the fact that children read comics, right?
Right.
We all grew up reading comics, and they were comics about comic characters, you know, gags and fun and sort of, you know, silly circumstance of one sort or another. Or in this country, anyway, in the UK, it tended to be war comics. We had this battery of all World War II comics that were never seen to be ending. So we had, on one hand, sort of silly slapstick, and then the other, it was kind of boys' own adventures. And there was a little bit of a niche for comics that dealt with gothic horror. There was the Frankensteins and the Draculas. And to be fair, there was also, just what you alluded to, sometimes classic novels would get a run out in a comic form. And obviously we had the great avalanche of American comics. So we had Batman and Superman and Captain America, et al., nonstop as well. So I'm just wondering if there's a little bit of an element where they were perceived for many years, up until the 1980s, I would say, as something which children did, and an adult reading a comic would be looked upon as almost something bizarre.
Right, right. It's funny because it kind of struck me a few years ago. I went into this, pretty well-known comic shop in Montreal where it has all the sort of literary comics or the indie comics, and they had a section for children's comics, and it seemed quite natural in a way because it's the readership of comics now is mostly adult, I would say. But taking a step back, I thought, oh, that's kind of funny that now they have to specify that these comics are aimed at children, this small subset of the bookstore. Because now I would say, I think probably comics are read mostly by adults.
I would agree.
It's almost
I would
more
agree.
Of a niche, you know.
I mean, I think I don't see children Not that I make a study of it, but I don't see children on trains, buses, or whatever sitting reading comics anymore. They're sitting playing with their phones often. Whereas I've been to the similar sorts of stores. We have them in London, or we had them in London. I don't know if they're still around. And they would be packed with largely men, middle-aged men, I have to say, buying you know, the latest graphic novel, or excited about the latest release from the Alan Moores of this world or whatever. So in some ways, probably, is it fair to say, Julian, that the graphic novel that has evolved and developed over the last 30 or 40 years, it may have a linkage with children's comics, but it's now a very tenuous one. It is completely a different art form designed for a totally different audience, right?
Yeah, I think so. I think it evolved out of that, but maybe more the principle, the language of pairing or telling a story through images. But I think maybe like even, well, maybe this is not a very accurate comparison, but the novel, which is one of the most prestigious cultural forms, or can be started as kind of a disparaged medium. I think it was seen as kind of light entertainment for women, right, in the 18th century. And it also dealt a lot with genre thing. It would be a lot of like horror or gothic, although of course it was very high level literature. But I think at the time it was perceived as being a little bit beneath like the intellectual set. But comics, yeah, is maybe an extreme example of that. But I think also people, well, unfortunately, people read less than they used to, and attention spans have gone down in every area, and maybe comics are a little bit easier to absorb, I think, or can be done so a little bit more quickly, too, than traditional literature. So that's kind of like the unfortunate reason maybe why comics are more popular now than they used to be.
I think as well, Julian, that we've had over 100 years of mass media visual entertainment. I'm talking about from the early days of cinema right the way through television, and now everywhere omnipresent through videos and phones and computers and all the rest. We're very, very comfortable with the visual image, and we are very, very adept at visual storytelling in a way that our ancestors perhaps were not. They were much happier with things being described on the page and that. Whereas now, I mean, a brief description or a brief snatch of dialogue from a character with a visual image, we kind of get it straight away. Do you think there's been a kind of an evolution of our appreciation of that sort of mixing and matching of the visual story form?
Yeah, no, that's very true. That's probably a very good point, that probably the original kind of storytelling emerged from literal storytelling. So it was an oral tradition, so it would make sense for then people to write it down and kind of have the images appear in their heads. But since comics and cinema, I think, emerged more or less around the same time, and comics were in fact described as the poor man's cinema back in the day, because they would cost less to purchase, but also to consume, but also of course to create. But they used a lot of the same techniques. And you can still see that in comics today. There's all the question of like sort of camera angles, what kind of shots to use, wide shots or close-ups. So it's the same. It's very similar visual language in terms of lighting too, even, I would say. So we're very used to that kind of visual language. It's true. So even people who haven't read comics before, I think, can very easily get into them and grasp them just on the basis of all the TV and film that they've watched throughout their lives. And I think even I teach comics. I feel like my students kind of, even the ones that don't read comics so much, have a natural kind of, or to some extent, a natural sense of how they should tell a story visually or frame a shot.
It's I don't know whether it's frustrating or whether it's flattering, but I have seen, for example, take the film Watchmen. I've read the graphic novel many years ago, and you could see how the film's director could almost take each page from the graphic novel as a storyboard. And, you know, I'm sure you're familiar with the concept of storyboarding in making movies. So for anybody who's listening who doesn't know, storyboarding is where the director and various other people, they get together and they work out scene by scene what things are going to look like. So they map it all out on a board normally, or that's how they did in the old days. And then when it comes to filming it, they're trying to realize that sort of ink and pen depiction that they have in front of them. Is it, as I say, a sort of maddening that directors can simply just pick up a graphic novel and say, well, my storyboarding is done? Or do you see it as flattering that they say, my storyboarding is done?
I think it's flattering. I think it is kind of interesting that cinema uses comics as source material so often, because it doesn't often happen the other way around. I think there's not a lot of comics that are based on movies, although that does happen. I've seen Star Wars comics or something. But generally, it's more cinema that borrows from comics, and maybe comics that will adapt novels into comics. So perhaps there is a certain sense of cultural prestige where the source material has a certain aura around it, and then it gets made into a movie. So I think in a way it is kind of setting up, it is giving a certain prestige or a certain place to comics that it can be used as a source of a multi-million dollar movie, even though the comic itself might have just sprung out of the mind of one person, and with no means they just were able to create it with just pen and paper and ink. But then it gets that kind of cultural legitimation or widespread mass appeal when it is turned into a movie. So, I think it's a nice thing.
Yeah, I mean, I can see the benefit for both comic creator and movie director. It can be equally beneficial to both. But in some ways, it does blur what are two very distinct art forms. Because not just that they are visual media, that's not exactly what I mean, but a cinematic experience, generally speaking, not exclusively, but generally speaking, is a communal experience. It's a communal sort of imagination, whereas graphic novels are closer to the novel, which is a very solitary engagement with a text and with the visuals of a text, and they are separate, right?
That's true, and in terms of engagement and also creation, I guess, because the novel and most of the time comics too are the creation of a single individual.
Right.
So it is that sort of emanation of one person's spirit, whereas a film is so collaborative and it involves so many people. It has to involve a lot of compromises, and it has to also appeal to usually a much larger market because you have to make a certain amount of profits to justify the expenses. So it is very different that way. I guess it's easier maybe in comics to experiment, to try something completely radical, because you don't necessarily have to worry about the costs or even convincing anyone else that it's worth doing. So there's that distinction still, I think. And maybe that's also partly why film needs to have or has relied so much on comics, because comics can be sort of the testing ground for a lot of the ideas, a lot of the artistic approaches before they have that big budget version come out.
Sure. What sort of reaction have you had, Julian? We're just about to finish up here, but just wondering, what reaction have you had to your Poems to See, a comic artist interprets great poetry book that you've released, where so many of these poems are illustrated through your comic prism?
Well, I mean, I have to say the reactions have been very, very positive. Very few negative reactions I can think of, but a lot of people have written to me to say that this collection of poems in comic book form has helped their children get into poetry for the first time, that or even they themselves, adults saying that they never really appreciated poetry before, and seeing them in this visual form was a great entry point. Other people will say that they love to see some of their favorite poems in comic book form and see how someone else has interpreted it and in what ways it resembles the images or the kind of stories that were always in their heads, in which way it's different or makes them see it in a different way. So yeah, I've been very gratified by the reaction it's gotten, and I'm hoping to eventually come up with a sequel, a second volume.
Yes, there's been some wonderful reviews for it online. I was just looking at one of them, where at the end, the person said, "By the end of the book, I almost felt like I owed the author, artist, an apology for doubting him. He enjoyed it so much," which is the best recommendation of all. Julian, very quickly, tell people where they can find out more about you and your work.
Okay. So you can go to my website, which is julianpeterscomics.com. I'm also on Instagram as julianpeterscomics, and you can find my debut collection, which is Poems to See by comic artists interpret great poetry. You can find it on Amazon. A lot of bookstores, especially independent bookstores, will carry it. And look for a sequel, hopefully sometime soon.
Thank you so much for taking time out this morning, Julian, to speak with us.
Thank you very much for your interest.
I was Julian Peters, who is a comic artist. Okay, when we come back, we will be praying the Divine Mercy Chaplet. Stay tuned to the Turley Frequency here live and exclusive on Archangel Radio.